Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb. And for those of you who may have seen the movie recently called God's Not Dead 2, you may have noticed that there were a couple of cameo appearances. And in fact, one of them was from our guest for this segment right now. His name is Jim Wallace, and he's a retired homicide detective who dealt with cold cases. And he wrote a book called Cold Case Christianity. Jim Wallace, and his website, by the way, is coldcasechristianity.com. Jim, welcome to the program. It's my privilege to have you on.
Well, thanks for having me. I so appreciate it.
Sure. Okay, so God's Not Dead 2, here you were in a mock court trial, or that's what the whole movie was about, that. And I never even heard of your book, but it just sounds absolutely fantastic. Tell us about the whole book and how it came about.
Well, I was somebody who was not raised in the church, and I was a pretty outspoken unbeliever, and I was also trained as a detective. I was working homicides in Los Angeles County. Most of my work toward the end of my career was all cold case murders that I've been working in.
What does that mean?
Well, these are unsolved murders. So the only crime that has no statute of limitations is a murder. So while other crimes expire after a number of years and we can't come after the perpetrator, you can always go back and revisit homicides, because those never expire. They stay open until
right.
someone goes to jail. So I worked those kinds of cases, and a lot of those got they're kind of high publicity cases because of the unusual nature of these cases. And so I often end up on shows like Dateline. And that's really how this all came about. And when I became a Christian, I really did it by way of employing the skills I had as a detective. Just looking seriously at the Gospels as eyewitness accounts, and are they reliable? What are the principles of eyewitness reliability? Applying those principles to the accounts, and then I came away at some point really convinced that these were an accurate description of what occurred in the first century with this man named Jesus of Nazareth.
Hmm. Okay, first of all, going back to your career as a detective in the cold case type situations, did this involve then DNA, forensics, or this just involved, as you said in the movie, no, it was just interviews, transcripts even, and some of these people were already dead by the time you were looking at these cases, and you were able, by the grace of God, to solve them.
Yeah, if you think about it, I mean, cold cases are events in the past, distant past, and I typically don't have any living eyewitnesses who can testify. That's why they're cold, because they didn't have those back in the day, so they're just not easy cases to solve. And sometimes when I open those books up to start the case, I will find myself looking at a report written about a witness who's no longer available because he or she is dead, and written by an officer who is also no longer available because he or she is also dead. So you have these reports in which you don't have access either to the original eyewitness or to the person who's writing about what the eyewitness reports. Now think about that for a second. That's very similar to the Gospels. And I realized pretty early on that this skill set that I had might work as I used it and applied it to the Gospel accounts.
Okay, now what got you interested in that?
Well, I think I'm trying to think, people always say, was there a moment in time? But what really got me interested was that my wife was somebody who was more willing to go to church than I was, and I was willing to go only if I could go as an atheist. And so that was really my approach. And my dad had done that for years, and I'd seen him do it, and so I was willing to do the same thing. And when I got into this church, I was about 35 years old. I'd never been in an evangelical church for any reason other than a funeral or a wedding. I'm sitting there on a Sunday, just trying to kill time, waiting for this to be over. And the pastor that day described Jesus in a way that I thought was interesting. He described Jesus as the smartest person who'd ever lived. And as, this pastor was clever enough to know that he probably had somebody in that audience that, was not going to accept Jesus the way that most Christians would. And that was me. And so I was interested in Jesus as a smart guy, somebody maybe who lived in the first century, who had some smart ethical teaching. And that's how I first got interested in the person of Jesus. And so I thought, well, in order to learn what Jesus had to say, I needed to go out and buy a Bible and start to go through it. I really didn't know what to expect. I had some familiarity with Christianity because as a kid, my mom was somebody who was raised kind of as a cultural Catholic. And so I had some familiarity with who Jesus was, but I really had no idea what to expect in the Gospels. And so I was approaching them pretty neutrally and just trying to figure out, what is reliable, what is not, And if I was to assess these the way I would assess other eyewitnesses, how would they rank? And that's really what got me started.
Hmm. Okay, and as you did, do you remember where you started? You started in Matthew, I assume, the beginning?
Yeah, I started in Matthew, but you know, I also knew that what we typically do in these kinds of cases, so when I work any kind of old case, is I don't just trust the first witness I talk to. I start to kind of gather information from other sources. And so I knew, for example, pretty early on, I was reading some of the early church fathers, reading some things that would help me to figure out what the nature of these accounts were. And I knew there was a claim in the first century that Mark's account, the Gospel of Mark, was written at the feet of Peter, mm-hmm. based on Peter's teaching in Rome. So one of the very first things I did was apply what is known as forensic statement analysis. This is a science or an art, really, that we apply to suspect statements, to looking for deception indicators, looking for things like this. And I thought, let me apply this this test to the Gospel of Mark to see if the fingerprints of Peter are really there, because they ought to be. If this is Peter's account that he's giving to Mark, there should be something distinctly Petrine, related to Peter in Mark's account. And so those are the kinds of things I was doing early on, just assessing the accounts, trying to figure out, are these really reliable accounts?
Did you find one? I mean, did you find Petrine influence?
Yeah, there's lots of things about Mark's account that are really unusual. For example, you know that Peter always does stupid things in the Gospels. It seems like he's one of the first guy to put his foot in his mouth in almost every Gospel, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at Mark's Gospel, you'll find that the embarrassing elements of Peter's narrative are for the most part either minimized or missing from Mark's account. Mark very seldom ever paints Peter in a bad light. And if he does, he'll typically say, Peter said this silly thing, and all the other disciples agreed. And so by adding that secondary statement, all the other disciples, it appears that he's trying to minimize how silly this statement really was on Peter's part. I mean, everyone was saying that kind of thing.
I've never noticed that. I will have to, next time I study Mark, I'll consider that. That's interesting.
That's the kind of stuff that really started to bug me. And it started to...
Why did
also,
it bug you? Bugged you as an atheist?
Yeah, because there were some aspects, the stuff we talked about in God's Not Dead too, when they're on the stand and they're asking me, about this thing I call unintentional eyewitness support. I'm not making that stuff up, and that's not just for the movie. That's exactly what I saw in the first reading of the Gospels. In other words, when you read multiple eyewitness accounts of a crime, the first witness you read will often raise a question because of the way they offer the account. They offer some statement, and you're going, really, how could that have happened? This doesn't make any sense. There's some ambiguity or there's some confusion in the statement of the witness, and it turns out you don't solve that. You don't resolve that ambiguity until you talk to two or three more witnesses, because they end up inserting a certain perspective that solves the thing that the first witness opened up. It solves the dilemma caused by the first witness. And I started to see this all the time in the Gospels, where one Gospel author will say something that seems a bit confusing. I offered one of these in the movie, right, where I talked about how Jesus is, in front of Caiaphas, and they're slapping him and saying, come on, Jesus, if you're the Christ, you can tell us who's slapping you. Prophesy, tell us who's hitting you. But they don't tell you in that first account that he's being blindfolded. In other words, if you don't tell me he's being blindfolded, it makes no sense that it's going to be prophecy to tell you who hit you. And of course, it's now a later account where you discover in Luke's account that no, he's actually blindfolded during this period of time. Now that makes sense of Matthew's first account where you weren't given that information, and it seemed kind of puzzling that they would call identifying the attacker prophecy. Well, you would call it that if in fact you were blindfolded, but this first account didn't give you that piece. It's the other account that gives it to you. And that kind of puzzling, you see all the time in reliable eyewitness accounts. And when I started to see it in Scripture, I was like, wow, I always assumed this is a work of fiction or a work of mostly fiction. And when I started to see the attributes that I see in real eyewitness accounts, it did bug me. And that's what got me looking even deeper and to see if I could, to apply the entire four-part template for reliable eyewitnesses. That's what I talk about in Cold Case Christianity, really, is how would we test eyewitnesses and do the Gospels pass the test?
Hmm, excellent. We're talking right now with Jim Wallace. Cold Case Christianity is the name of his book. His website is coldcasechristianity.com. So how long was the period from when you started studying the Gospels again, as a retired detective, to when you finally crossed the line and became a believer in Jesus?
You know, my wife and I were talking about this again last week because I'd love to be able to answer that question accurately.
Roughly.
But I know this. I know that I started at some point in 1996, and I have a name tag from, I think, the spring of 97 when I was serving in children's ministry. So sometime between there, I always kind of estimated around 6-7 months that I spent really digging, and it was obsessive. I mean, I would spend a couple hours a day working like a case, and I think my wife thought I was crazy, but I would really, you know, kind of pick apart word by word, and I talk about this in the book. You know, every word matters to detectives. What you say, how you say it, the kinds of pronouns you use, the kinds of adjectives and adverbs you use, the way you compress time or expand time in your statement, these things matter to detectives when they're listening to a statement. And all those things mattered to me. And to work through every one of those in each gospel takes some time. And I still have the first Bible I did this with where I was using forensic statement analysis.
Oh, that'd be neat to look at those notes.
It's fun to look at those notes.
Yeah, really.
All color-coded.
All right, now
We
only have about 3 minutes left, and I would like to focus on the resurrection. One of the first things liberals like to do is say, oh, if you look at the resurrection accounts, they contradict themselves. So your comments on the resurrection. And take your time. We have about 3 minutes left.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when you see apparent contradictions, I can tell you that if we had a witness today to a crime that occurred today and we had 3 or 4 eyewitnesses to that crime, I guarantee you, if we do a good job of separating them so they don't have a chance to talk to each other, and I always make sure my officers on scene separate the eyewitnesses because I don't want to get there and have 4 statements where they're all saying the same thing. Because that's not what real, reliable eyewitness testimony sounds like. Because we have different perspectives. We have different life histories that allow us and cause us to focus in on different attributes.
Okay, excellent. So the resurrection. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, you see, for example, that Mary runs to the tomb, and is she encountering one angel or is she encountering two? There seems to be a discrepancy on the resurrection account, right? But of course, if the focus is on the one angel with whom she had a conversation, then unless you are able to ask her the follow-up question, okay, Mary, you're only describing one angel. Can you tell me, were there two angels? Then you really have no way to resolve that. And that's what we appear to have a contradiction here, right? One account says two, one account says one. But I know from working these kinds of cases, there really is no contradiction because no one was able to ask her the follow-up question. And if they had, she would have resolved it. But for her, she was focused, in one account, is focused on what the speaking angel had to say. So it only records the presence of the one speaking angel. That is so common in eyewitness accounts. And so if I was to see this in lifetime, I would ask her, hey, was there a second angel? And she would tell me. But if I'm, you know, looking at it 2,000 years later, I can't ask that question. But I would never toss the account under the bus as unreliable based on something like that because I know how these things work in real life, and it would certainly be within the range of what I would expect.
Okay, what else do you want to say about the resurrection in terms of your, you know, former investigative work as a detective?
Well, let me just real quickly try to say how I approach the resurrection. We call it abductive reasoning. And basically we take a list of all the evidence in the room of any scene and all the explanations for that evidence. And we simply go back and forth between the evidences and the explanations to see which explanation best accounts for all the evidence. And I did this with the resurrection. We have an empty tomb. We have people who reported seeing the risen Jesus. We have people who seem to be transformed after seeing the risen Jesus. We have somebody who died on a cross, you know, and was buried. These are minimal pieces of evidence we all agree on related to the resurrection of Jesus. Even if you're an atheist, most people will give you those simple, brief outline of the story. The question is, there's 7 ways to describe this. I can't go into all of them right now, of course. And one of those 7 explanations is just the Christian explanation. What I did was I went through all 7 explanations in detail to see which explanation accounted for the evidence best with the least number of liabilities. This is called abductive reasoning. And as I did that, and I do this in one of the chapters in the book, I think it's chapter 2 in the book, where we simply go through all of the explanations using abductive reasoning, you'll see, and I give you an example in the book of a real death scene and how this works in the death scene, but if you do that, you'll come down to really the best explanation is the Christian explanation. It only has one liability, that's that it requires a resurrection, but you cannot deny the possibility of a resurrection if what you're trying to investigate is whether or not a resurrection occurred, because that's a circular reasoning. You have to suspend your disbelief for a second, look at the evidence, look at the explanations, and you'll find that the Christian explanation for the events in the first century is by far the most reasonable.
This is such a terrific, terrific subject, terrific book. I look forward to reading it. Jim Wallace, Cold Case Christianity. Again, the website is coldcasechristianity.com. Thanks so much for being with us. God bless you, sir.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate being
with you. All right. Thank you now. Bye-bye.